don't we go to Scott Atran, who I hope will stay. Just to read again from Jonathan Glover, who this is a piece from The Guardian where he said, "The West and Islam must acknowledge the truth in both their stories. Dialogue is the only way to end the cycle of violence." So that's part of what we're trying to do today, the Come Let Us Reason Together. He also makes the comment here, "Dialogue may sound vacuous, but that is misleading. In our own country, we need not just any old talk, but some quite deep and sustained discussion of particular issues. Different systems of belief on each side and the different narratives of recent history," and I would add that neuroscience as well. Scott Atran is...
What? They got the wrong thing up.
Research director of the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris. He wrote a significant book, In Gods We Trust, The Evolutionary Landscape of Religion and the Native Mind. And has a new book... he has a new book called The Native Mind, Cognition and Culture in Human Knowledge of Nature, right? And spends more time on planes between here and the White House and Islamic countries than anybody I know. So, Scott Atran.
So the goal, my interest here is to give you a reality check about what terrorism is about. So far I've heard mostly ignorance and nonsense. You people really have no idea what it's about. Most of you probably get it from news reports. News reports follow a power law distribution. That is, very few sources of information are responsible for almost all information in the world. And that information has an error rate of between 30% and 40%. If you look at Reuters or the New York Times or any of the recent articles, for example, on the Madrid trial, which came to a conclusion yesterday, you'll find the error rate is even greater. It's mostly nonsense. And my interest in science is to try to face what I think is the basic irrationality of humankind that's not going to go away, and try to use science to understand it and leverage it where we can to stop killing and to make breakthroughs in seemingly intractable conflicts. Sorry. Does anybody know how this... God.
There might be two of them up there. They're out there. Right? Each guy's awesome. He's probably both of them. One person broke that once.
All right. I will start while they're trying to figure this out. We've heard that... religion, science, and philosophy may have roles to play in taming the demons and monsters within us. And that religion has done a particularly bad job. In fact, they've encouraged the demons and monsters within us. I think religion is basically a neutral vessel. It's done everything you can imagine, and it's contrary. And there's nothing intrinsic... there's nothing intrinsic about religion for the good or for the bad. Again, any function you can conceive of for religion, the contrary has also been true in human cultures. Today, in the world, monks in Burma are defending freedom, as no one else is. And during the Rwanda crisis, when the United Nations completely backed out and the United States was an abject coward, the only people to systematically save animists were Muslim clerics, who saved thousands, many thousands. So religion can do good things, and of course it can do horrible things. To say, as was said by a Nobel Prize winner last year, there are both good and bad non-religious and religious people, but only religious people teaches good people to be bad, is a lesson in bad faith. Religion can just as well teach bad people to be good. This, in fact, is the history of human redemption and interest in it. To picture the Twin Towers still standing with what if there were no religion as a moral call to action is politically ignorant. If you read bin Laden's justification for his war against the United States, he writes, "Even if God had not granted us the gift of Islam, our pagan ancestors would have refused the arrival of these red mules. He goes on in his 1996 fatwa to outline why in our jahiliyyah, in our pagan past, we would have had no choice but to fight the United States. Why not propose to government leaders from around the world that preaching God is dead would help? Would that help them resolve their deep-seated political conflicts today? Now? Think about it. I proposed that to 30 ambassadors a couple of days ago, and the reaction was, why do you let this guy talk? It's not the denial of religion that's or God that's nuts. I do it all the time. I deny God, I deny religion, and I'm not nuts. It's the denial of the meaning of religion to human psychology and to human history. That's nuts. To believe it's going to go away and you're just going to argue it away through reason, that's nuts. But it's been tried before. Nietzsche and Nechayev were one of a wave in the 19th century of philosophers who tried to do it. I think the present exercise is frivolous. It's mostly an hysterical reaction to 9/11. I think previous attempts have been much more dangerous. In human history, it was only in the middle of the 19th century that large segments of humanity became aware, much to their general surprise and rather unpleasantly, that intricate and abstruse philosophies, the bastard childs of the Enlightenment, could directly influence their lives and kill them. I don't think that scientists, even the very best of us, have any special insight into moral problems. To be a good scientist, you have to be telescoped on a particular problem. If you're not, you can't do science. Now, you can have broad views. That's not impossible. But in general, I don't see the scientists having much better moral intuitions than the baker on the corner street. There have been statements about Muslims and Muslim radicalization that I just want to make clear. Religious education is inversely proportional, okay? It's a negative predictor of being involved in violence in the jihad. It is a negative predictor of being radicalized in prison. As far as madrasas are concerned, we've done, I think, the only serious study of madrasa. We've taken every single terrorist incident to date known. Okay, we've analyzed where they come from, what their origins were, how they got to where they did, and of about 60,000 madrasas, 15 have been involved in violence. 15. So that's like saying, well, Columbine had a bunch of crazy kids. We should shut down the high schools in the United States. One example, you know, scientists are not immune to supernatural entities, too. We believe in memes. Well, some of us do. These are things that don't exist in space and time. They can't be pinned down. They're in constant flux. I think that knowing evolutionary constraints on moral judgments can help us not make mistakes. So communism tried to convince us that there was not any intrinsic competition between human beings for status and prestige and wealth, and you can just deny it and it would go away. Of course, that ran up against human nature, as we all know. But I don't think that evolutionary intuitions or studies about human morality are going to help us much in a global world where strangers and nations and the globe itself is at play, because evolution didn't produce that understanding any more than it produced understanding in us of the infinitely small and the infinitely big. We're not intuitive quantum physicists, and we're not intuitive Darwinians any more than we're intuitively able to judge moral propositions for strangers and nations. I do think that morality, working with different kinds of scientific findings about morality, can help us compose something new to deal with this. But again, I don't see any automatic or obvious way to do this. I'm one scientist who's very pessimistic about our species. We have intermittently killed one another. Violence follows violence itself. In the human race follows a power law distribution. That is, violence, quotidian violence, is actually declining, but very few events are causes for major, major violence that's tens of millions of people. And if you follow it up to the next level, that is the next outbreak, the prediction is hundreds of millions of people will be dead. Okay? As for current forms of terrorism, as I said, there's an inverse correlation between getting involved in religion and in violence, and a very little influence of the madrasas. So it's nonsense to claim that Al-Qaeda's viral movement is a nihilistic movement. It's a deeply, deeply moral movement. The ultimate ambition of global jihad is to inaugurate a just and righteous society for believers the world over. There is no, let me go back one. At this point, the NOS dynamic terrorists belong to spontaneously self-generated, self-organized networks of friends and kin who are radicalized collectively and collectively decide to carry out terrorist operations. There were some claims made, just as an aside, about the theories of evolution of religion. John Haidt and David Sloan Wilson argued, I think they even said the byproduct theory was the dominant theory, although there were only three of us 20 years ago who had it, and that it should be replaced by group selection. When I asked Jonathan, can you give me a single empirical example of group selection, he says, well, no, I can't, but maybe David can. So as God is my witness and Darren, I asked David, can you give me a single example? He says, well, we'll talk about it next time. Well, David's not here to defend himself. But I don't think there's any evidence whatsoever that religion is an adaptation or has a group selection function. None, zero, not the slightest bit of empirical evidence. And I think from a theoretical point of view, my test case is suicide bombers. I mean, death's the ultimate behavioral variable. These guys die for their group. But I find nothing remotely resembling group selection involved in what they do. These are mostly young men who form groups of fictive kin and die for one another, die for their buddies, and dreams of glory the way people in armies do, in elite units. There is no indoctrination in the jihad. There's never has been. There's been no recruitment of the jihad. People don't come out and say, ah, will you be a jihadi? People don't brainwash jihadis. Not a single case. Well, there is a single case. They come knocking at the door, even in Al-Qaeda's heyday. They came knocking at the door to Afghanistan, and Al-Qaeda accepted 10 to 15%. There is no Al-Qaeda in Europe. There never has been an Al-Qaeda in Europe. There's no agent of Bin Laden out there trying to get people to bomb things. Young men try to find their way to Waziristan or Iraq, usually through a relative, sometimes through 6 degrees with a piece of paper introducing one to the next. Sometimes they hook up with someone who had been in a training camp. Today they get about 3 weeks training if they get there, and that's less than 5% because Al-Qaeda is basically destroyed. Out of 1,000 of the core people who gave bayat to Bin Laden, there are less than 100, and it's dwindling almost daily. They're all stuck in Waziristan, where the largest camp has 24 people. That's Mir Ali in northern Waziristan. And the 20 other camps are 6 people with 1 trainer apiece, and they're constantly fluid. That's it. That's the extent of Al-Qaeda. Okay? So it's not an existential threat against the United States. So you've got these young men. Even Mohammed Atta, we spent a lot of time with people in his group, families involved, the neighbors. They indoctrinated themselves. They holed up in an apartment for months on end, lived in a parallel universe, bought in 20 mattresses, and try to imitate the life of the prophet. The neighbors told us the place stunk. And these are middle-class neighborhoods outside the technical university in the Hamburg suburb of Harburg. Then they thought, maybe we'll go to Chechnya. Well, maybe not. Maybe we'll go to Kosovo. But the Kosovos, the Albanians, didn't want them for anything. And they said, OK, we'll go to Afghanistan. In which time, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said, hey, boss, we got something here. And the plot was done fairly rapidly. That was the first wave. These were mostly intelligent students, engineers, doctors, or would be engineers and doctors, but that's not the case anymore. There's no financing for Al-Qaeda. This was the most expensive operation, 9/11, cost $400,000. The next most expensive operation is Madrid and Bali, and that cost less than $50,000, and it's all entirely self-funded. But because there's no funds being given to these people, they're forced to ride piggyback on already existing clandestine networks. And these are usually criminal networks. Drug, credit card fraud, car parts. This is describing what it is. I mean, people, I hear the headlines in the New York Times. Oh, the Crevice plot. This is the plot to blow up Heathrow Airport. Al-Qaeda has been caught. Al-Qaeda has been tried. The Al-Qaeda threat has been dampened for now. This is a joke. These guys went to Pakistan. One of them had a relative who knew somebody who had been to a camp someday. They figured out they got themselves a trainer. They had to pay 3,500 euros to the trainer. They had to pay for the apartment. They had to pay for all their equipment, and then they went back. That's the biggest operation. The chief impetus for global jihad now comes from the US war in Iraq, not from madrasas. People go to Iraq to fight and die. That's not where the problem is. They don't come back to Europe. People go to Pakistan to train and come back. That's where the danger is today in the world. Foreign fighters in Iraq are a very small part of the insurgency, just as the Arabs were a very small part of the insurgency in Afghanistan. And there is very little indication of any serious plot hatched from people coming back from Iraq. There's no Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. I can go on and all about this. This is a formal structure that the Moroccan intelligence gave us about how this Moroccan group is formed. And these guys all come from the neighborhood, and they hang around in cafes, and there's no formal structure, and bin Laden's not out there. And there's no hierarchical organization, command and control, recruitment, or brainwashing. It's about flat and fluid networks of friends, families, neighbors, schoolmates, workmates, and soccer buddies who self-radicalize and go looking for Al-Qaeda. Increasingly in cyberspace, it is the internet that is giving them their greatest impetus to act today. This is just the Jamaa Islamiya. This is the most hierarchically structured of all the jihadi groups left after Al-Qaeda. And you can see we've plotted all the kinship relationships. It's mostly families. Here are some of the marriages involved in making the plots. Weddings is where people really make plots. Okay, wedding ceremonies and restaurants, not mosques. People go to mosques to pray. They don't go to mosques to plot. So let me just briefly go through one of these plots, and that's the Madrid plot, again, which was finally reached its end yesterday. So you started off back up in 1994 with those three guys up there at the top. They're Spaniards. These are losers. They work in a mine, and they sell dynamite to fishermen to blow up fish, and they get thrown in prison. These guys on the left, they all live in one square block in the town, in the neighborhood of Jemaa Mezouak in northern Morocco. And the guys on the right are mostly Syrian refugees from Hafez al-Assad's crackdown in the 1980s against the Muslim Brotherhood. These guys were tried as being the Al-Qaeda cell in Madrid after 9/11, of having received Atta and some of the others. The Garzón, Baltasar Garzón, who's this great hero for arresting all these guys, the Spanish Supreme Court overturned all their convictions. There was no evidence whatsoever that they had anything to do with Al-Qaeda. What happens is they get put in prison. Garzón puts them all in prison. And a group of young students, Moroccans, fairly alienated, start meeting with one another. And with Yarkas, he's that supposed leader, the Syrian leader of Al-Qaeda in Madrid. I should mention that the same thing is true of Mohammed Atta and his friends, Ramzi Bilnawshi, Ben Shehi, and Jarar, and the others. The reason they got together in the university was because the Moroccans formed a group of friends in the restaurants and in the mosques, and all the people who weren't Moroccans, the double alienated guys, became the Hamburg plotters in the dorms and in the apartments. This is where they used to chant jihadi songs at the Naval Carnero River and have picnics with one another and play soccer. And then what happens is, this guy, Zuhair, I have a wonderful picture of him. He's a male strip dancer. He's in jail with these losers, the Spanish guys, the dynamite guys, right? And he's got a police handler named Victor. And Victor says, hey, Rafa, go back up to northern Asturias and try to get a market for this dynamite so we can get these guys again. Well, Zuhair has a friend, Aglif, known as the Rabbit, who's hooked up with these drug guys from this northern Moroccan barrio. This guy, he's about this tall. He's about 4'10". He's the kind of guy, as his friends say, he looks you in the eye. He tells you, he's going to kill you. No matter how big you are, you shit in your pants. He's just got out of prison for murder. These guys have been chanting about jihad for 2.5 years. Do nothing. We know that because the substitute imam at the mosque was a police informant, so we have almost daily reports of what they were doing. Jamal comes back on June 29th, 2003. One of his friends, the Ulad Akshas, link him to Serhani. Where are you, Serhani? There you are. Who is a substitute preacher at the Alonso Cano Mosque in central Madrid. Jamal is an out-of-control guy. He's an impulsive guy, okay? He goes out and kills people. He runs drug rings. But he comes out thoroughly radicalized. He wants to kill Jews in Palestine. That's his big thing. When they ask him to belong to a Sufi organization in prison called Justice and Charity, which is against the king and quite religious, he says, no, I want something violent. He comes out. He meets up with Serhani. They bind like this. His wife, Rosa, tells us that he came home, he kissed her, they walked in the park, but within a month, she didn't see him anymore. She's a Christian woman that he met when she was 14 years old. He's with Serhani all the time, and what happens is Serhani and his boys start hooking up with Ahmiran and his drug buddies from Tetuan, and this is where Ahmiran used to traffic drugs in the Lavapiés neighborhood in the Plaza de Cabasteros. This is where they all used to meet at the Alhambra restaurant and have sandwiches. And they bond. And the interesting thing is, most of the guys fall out from the religious group. Half of the guys fall out from the drug group because they don't want to be religious. And these guys, they don't want to do anything. They just want to talk. So what happens is you get a bonding, almost accidental, of these guys. And it's Zuhair, this male strip dancer, who just got 10 years in prison yesterday, he is the one who figures out to exchange dynamite for hashish and make bombs. Now, the interesting thing is that 4 of the 7 Madrid bombers who blew themselves up at the end all were Jamal's friends. They were drug runners. They had nothing to do with jihad. Zero. They were drug runners, and they blew themselves up. And the ones who escaped because they were taking out the garbage when the police was coming, they wound up in Iraq, and they blew themselves up. We went to their neighborhoods where they live. This is the neighborhood in the Jamal Mezuak barrio of Tetuan, and they all grew up here. And lo and behold, when we found out that the 4 of the 7 guys who blew themselves up in Madrid came from this little neighborhood, we found that there were about 12 suicide bombers who had just gone to Iraq, 4 of which had been identified by their DNA, sent the Moroccan authorities by the Americans. So this 2-block area, okay, has sent maybe up to 30 suicide bombers. None of them are religious, to tell you the truth. This is the mosque where many of them prayed, but it's not the mosque. It's the Chicago Cafe. It's the soccer field where they're all soccer buddies. All the guys who went to Iraq to blow themselves up that we have the DNA for, they're all soccer friends. When we asked the police, who were trying to figure out in Madrid what was going on, we said, hey, is there a soccer field? Oh, yes, there's a soccer field by the Ulad Akshas. We asked the people in the neighborhood who was playing soccer. Happened to be all the guys that eventually became the plotters. Now, I go into the neighborhoods, and I ask these guys, the young guys, who are your heroes? What are your dreams? Okay? Because that's what you've got to fight. You've got to fight their heroes. You've got to fight their dreams. And this is the list, about 50 people, 50 young. It's the little kids who talk to me in my broken Arabic. They speak Moroccan Arabic, which I can't understand. I use Levantine. And number one is Ronaldinho. He's the Brazilian soccer star for the Barca club. Number two is Ito. He's the black Brazilian soccer star. Number three is the Terminator. They have no idea that he's related to the present governor of California. And number four is Osama bin Laden. I should say, this is the Plaza de Salvador Servos in Ceuta, which is the Spanish enclave just north of the Jamal Mezuak, belongs to Spain. There are two cafes here, one right there, which belongs to the Madrid club, one that belongs to the Barca club. Al Jazeera is on all the time, and the kids sit there, and the brothers sit there, and they comment on the news. I don't know if any of you watched Al Jazeera. You get 15 minutes of Iraq with people running through the streets with their kids' brains falling out. You get 10 minutes of Palestine, which isn't as bad, but it's pretty gruesome. And you get 1 minute for the rest of the world. And the people watch this. So people, television is very important. People watch this, and let me tell you, you would want to join the jihad. They say, how can they do that? How can people let these people kill children like this? Okay? We've got to do something. It's a little bit like Jews who say, never again. Never will we allow this to happen again. That's what you've got to combat. All right. Just a very fast sort of conclusion. What is radicalization all about? First of all, we've done, I think, the only empirical studies that show that humiliation has nothing to do with it. Humiliation is negatively correlated with willingness to commit violence, okay? What does do it is moral outrage. They're doing it to our people. And it only works if that moral outrage resonates with your personal experience. In the United States, there is no possibility. Why? Because Muslims in America buy into the American dream. Their demographic profile is exactly the average. They are underrepresented in prisons, just like Jews are, and they're thoroughly integrated. In Europe, they're 5 to 20 times likely to be poor. Their representation in the prison population ranges from 60 to 80% of the total prison population. You know how many, by the way, talk about hysteria. We have Congress, and I've testified before many committees, pushing billions of dollars to fight radicalization. Does anybody have any idea how many Muslims have been radicalized in U.S. prisons? Take a wild guess. Two. Exactly. Folsom Prison. You knew this. One out of a million. That's very low. Very low. And these were two losers. One was a son of a Black Panther, and the other guy was a member of an L.A. gang. And they spent most of their time fighting to try to get the L.A. gang guy didn't want to take off his tattoos. And the other guy said, no, to assimilate in the population, you have to take off tattoos. Anyway, they finally got some guys to do this, and they dropped a telephone on the outside. And the FBI put 500 people on this case. 500. They took the entire St. Louis FBI on these two losers. Now imagine that. As some guy in the White House told me, it's the golden age for drug traffickers, white-collar crime, and the mob. So what's the wrong thing to do? So the Quadrennial Defense Review of the United States Defense Department minimized U.S. costs in terms of lives and treasure while imposing unsustainable costs on the enemy. Well, jihadis don't respond to utilitarian cost-benefit analyses. They respond to moral values and are more than willing to die for the cause. The more pressure you put on them, the more they're willing to die. We have a couple of articles in the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences and in Science magazine in August with some empirical results on the role of these kinds of sacred values in conflict. This is an interview I did with the emir of Jamaa Islamiyah, who basically tells you why people are willing to sacrifice themselves. We find non-rational thinking. There is no transitivity of preferences in their thinking. And you find weird kinds of things like, would you postpone a martyrdom operation to aid a sick father? Of course we would. Would you postpone a martyrdom operation to save your whole family from certain death, including the father? Of course not. Now, that doesn't make much rational sense, right? But it makes a lot of moral sense. Social welfare is not a solution. These guys get bored and they sit around and are more likely to surf the net and join jihad. Especially in the Middle East, don't attempt to discredit Salafi ideology. It's only going to backfire. And the only people who have actually seen get people away from suicide squads are Salafis. Stop trying to impose freedom and democracy. The values are justice and fairness. Now, they're not incompatible at all, but it is fairness and justice that plays the role in their societies as freedom and democracy does for us. And unless the two can resonate one another, I mean, making an election and having people put up their purple thumb is very much like the old English colonials who used to put wigs on people and throw them in courts in the middle of Africa and say, ah, you have laws. Stop wasting millions of dollars studying the Quran. They know nothing about the Quran, absolutely nothing, okay? 90% of these guys are born again, 90%. They have no religious education. Their religious education consists of, there's a war in Islam, it's heroic to kill Americans. I mean, I'm in Borneo and Sulawesi, literally tribes that were cannibals just two generations ago. All they want to do is fight Americans in Iraq. It's the most heroic thing in the world right now. Stop wasting hundreds of millions of dollars with widgets. That's what our Defense Department does. Great grants with physicists doing scale-free modeling, and it has absolutely no relationship to anything in the world. Stop a catch-all approach to radicalization. It's very context-sensitive. I gave you the case. Much more public transparency by law enforcement. The English are the worst, and it's not their fault. The English are the worst because there's a law that says there cannot be no discovery until after the trial. There can be no public vetting of information. So the community is locked out. You get arrests. The people are very suspicious. The authorities say, trust us, and then they blow away a Brazilian and say, oops, it's a mistake. We're much more successful in the United States. The NYPD is by far the best, okay, because they're scared to death there's going to be another attack, and if there's another attack, all money leaves Wall Street, and they're very serious. They got thousands of these guys on this. They reflect their ethnic community. They go into the ethnic community. They say, we don't want a problem. You don't want a problem. Let's work together, and they're all over the world. They're far and away better than the CIA and the FBI. The Turkish National Police, forget your images of Midnight Express, they're the best, okay? Their intelligence people are educated 4 to 8 years in the university. They got 150 of them here in the United States, Columbia, Harvard, Rutgers, and other kinds of places. And their way of doing it is, they come back from Afghanistan, let's give them presents for Ramadan, let's sit in the family, let's give them hospital care, let's talk. What to do? You got to deal with the structural problems of social alienation. If the police are intrusive and culturally alien, then the war on Islam will be more half-felt. Most important thing is things like the Boy Scouts. Remember I told you, the greatest predictor, you know, there are millions of people who support the jihad. The greatest predictor from going from support to violence has nothing to do with religion. It has to do whether you belong to a soccer club or not, or something like that. So Boy Scouts and football teams are going to be much more important, things like that, than studying the Quran. Provide, and this is the last slide, provide for alternate dreams and heroes that youth can connect to. Look at the new comic book series of Muslim superheroes modeled on Marvel Comics that's catching the attention of Muslim youth in Indonesia and now around the world. Science can be part of that dream, but it's got to be targeted to them. Faith and dreams and heroes, perhaps more than industry and power, gives impetus to lives and civilizations. I think their view is going nowhere, but they have the impetus. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. So despite all the signs and everything, we're way late. So two quick questions. We've got to go to a break, then we've got to come back and do some neuroscience so that this stuff is actually grounded in brains. Two quick questions. Jerry Ostrom.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting. You're probably familiar with the very controversial effort at prediction markets that the Defense Department funded. Some economist friends of mine, actually. Do you have a view on that, and do you have a comment on the Patriot Act?
I'll start with Patriot Act. When the United States and the Soviet Union were at one another's necks, there were, estimates range, but there were tens of thousands of nuclear weapons that could have destroyed the United States and the Soviet Union and wiped out about 500 million people in 90 minutes. And actually what saved us from that was one person, his name is Vasily Arkhipov. During the Soviet missile crisis, the United States depth-charged a Soviet sub. The Americans did not know that Khrushchev had given operational command of the release of nuclear missiles to the submarine commanders. If they voted unanimously, two voted to release nuclear torpedoes. Vasily
vetoed it, and that's why we're all here today. That was a real existential threat. We could have all disappeared. This is not. These guys, in their wildest dreams, and let me tell you, they're pretty much incompetent losers. They sometimes get lucky. They could do a 1 kiloton fizzle bomb, which would kill about 200,000 people. That's a lot of people, but that's not an existential threat to society. The existential threat comes from the reaction, as it is today, to such an attack. Three Algerians from Paris blow up a park bench with a nuclear bomb in New York City. Tehran, let me tell you, will be vaporized within 24 hours. That's what will happen, and that's what will be a great thing. The trouble is the Patriot Act, I don't think, has much relevance at all to who these guys are. I don't think it's doing anything except either scaring some people, namely civil libertarians, that this is out of control, or reassuring other people who can't understand this phenomena. You know, they say Al-Qaeda, 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 when there isn't no Al-Qaeda, okay, and that are psychologically helped by it. Okay, now for financial markets. You mean the Poindexter thing where they were going to bid? I think that's a fantastic idea. Fantastic idea. And I think it's crazy that it was dropped. I think they would have gotten the best, from people who aren't familiar with the field, but they would have gotten the best they could have gotten. I mean, just like Wikipedia. They would have been mistakes, but it would have been fantastic. Yeah.
Okay. Beatrice, do you have a microphone? Well, in that case, would you hang on for a second?
2 points. First, I completely agree with you that radicalization does not rely on religion per se, but I think to say that it doesn't also occur in mosques is naive and demonstrably untrue. There are many videotapes of imams passionately fomenting violence within a mosque setting, and I personally have, as a patient, an African-American Muslim who told me after 9/11 he began being ostracized from others at his mosque because he refused to listen and participate in fomenting of hatred against and violence toward America. The second point is I'm curious how you think football teams will help and why they would be different from soccer teams.
Okay, on your first point about my claim about the unimportance of mosques and imams being demonstrably false, I don't think a single anecdote is going to do it. We've got a database that involves thousands of cases, including all known cases of all terrorist attacks ever done, and it's not a significant factor. That's just a fact. Okay, so if you can show me countervailing data, I'd go for it, but we don't find it.
To claim that there isn't a role for that even within those social networks is not validatable, frankly.
What do you mean? Show me. If you believe that mosques are important, do mosque attendance. By the way, mosque attendance is also a negative predictor, but I'm not holding my breath. And as far as soccer teams go, it's not just soccer teams, right? It's the fact that all jihadi activities that we know of, there's never a case of a lone wolf, except very recently some guys, high school guys, had bound up on the internet, and so one guy actually went out with a bomb, the first case we know of, but his buddies are in the chat rooms, right? But it's a group thing. It's usually 8 to 12 guys because that's where your primary ties are against when you leave your family. You bound with buddies from 18 to 30 years old. After 30, it's geezerhood. And those ties that you make in your late teens and early 20s will drive you throughout your life. And those are the people you're going to die for just as much as you would die for a family, even more during those particular years. Now, the only difference between people in general who do this and the guys who actually go out and blow themselves up or blow other people up is that one of them decides to do it and brings his buddies along. I mean, the Madrid guys, one guy was a candy salesman in the Jamaa Mazuwak. His father told us he had nothing to do with religion, but he looked up to that little guy, you know, I said he'd look at you and you'd shit in your pants. He took care of him. And so this guy says, we're going to blow ourselves up. He blew himself up. Okay, so if you can get groups, I mean, that's what the Boy Scouts were all about. That's what high school football was all about, to get people off the streets. You've got to get into their neighborhoods, into their cafes, into their restaurants, into their chat rooms, because that's where it all is. It ain't in the mosques, it ain't in the imams, and it sure ain't.